Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And we have another another European guest this evening. We have someone from the UK, and his name is Jason Gleaves, and he's been researching UFO photos and videos and things, and we're going to be talking about that and his background. Should be a good show. Alejandro Rojas cannot make it. I think he said he's in Las Vegas. He's interviewing an astronaut. So he said he had a full schedule today, just couldn't make it. So, hey, so in that case, I'm going to say if anyone's a live listener and they just want to call in and talk about a sighting, you're welcome to do that. And we're going to put the number up on the screen. I'll give that number out. I should have been prepared, but I don't have it up there right now. So that number is 603-967-4030 if you'd like to call in and talk about a sighting. If not, I have a couple of sightings that I want to talk about on my podcast UFO.com page. We have a sightings page and it's anonymous. I'll get back to that, but I do want to thank everyone that does support the show. I really appreciate that. Anyone can do that. You just have to find the menu bar on podcastufo.com, support the show, and you can go there. If you can't support the show, you want to listen for free, you can show up on podcastufo.com every Wednesday evening at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Or you can also listen over at the Dark Matter Digital Network, and that is on Thursdays as a pre-recorded show, and that is 10 to midnight. Also, you can watch live on YouTube. Our shows are first recorded live on YouTube and then made into an audio podcast. That's how that goes. Again, I want to thank everyone that supports the show. And if anyone wants to call in, you're listening live, talk about a sighting, you can call now. 603-967-4030 is the number. So on Podcast UFO, before I invite our guests, I just wanted to talk about I have this page called the UFO Sightings page, and I also have an anonymous form that anyone can fill out. You don't have to remain anonymous, but you have that option. So anyway, it's getting pretty active. We're having a number of sightings, and we have a great video that just came up. That's in Everett, Washington, happened back in mid-March. And check the video out if you go to our website. It's really, really interesting. Can't quite figure out what that is. We also have a sighting up. Oh, someone's calling in. They did call in, and it looks like they hung up. Try again. That number's on the screen now, so you can see that number on the screen. I don't know if you hung up or you got cut off, but do try calling back. So we also have a sighting someone posted, and that it's strange lights in Victoria, in Australia, and there's a picture there also. It's a great looking, really weird looking picture, and check that out. We have rectangle UFOs, and then we have a person talking about his grandfather's encounter. He was part of the 509th bomb group in Roswell. That's not when he's had the sighting, but he was just making a note that he was. Also, we have a Ontario, Canada sighting. And a lot of great ones, so I hope you check that out. It's on podcastufo.com, and you're welcome to post your sightings there. Well, if the caller doesn't try to call me back, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our guest. So I'll give you a couple seconds here. That is really all I can think of to talk about. It's been kind of a slow week. I was on Alejandro's show the other day, and we were talking about sightings lately, and not too much going on. So I don't even know what he would talk about, actually, to be honest with you, if he came on the show. So anyway, we are ready to bring on our guest. He actually was in, as they say, in England. He was in the military. He was in the Royal Air Force in 1986. He went in at 17 years of age. He had a sighting too young. We're going to talk about that. Welcome to the show, Jason. Can you hear me, Jason?
Yeah, I can hear you.
I forgot to unmute.
Martin.
Right? Hi, welcome to the show. And it's like 1 o'clock in the morning for you. So thank you so much for staying awake.
Yeah, that's okay. Thank you for inviting me on.
Sure. And your book, what inspired you to write your book? Is this all about the research you've been doing lately?
Yeah, basically, it was sort of the next step after I brought out UFO pages on Facebook and Twitter and all different media. And it was just really the natural progression onwards to bring out a book, really, of the analysis that I do on different photographs.
So a lot of your work was started on Facebook. You have a Facebook page, and it's basically called what you call everything else. And what's that called again? UFO what?
UF only. It's basically on all the different formats. And I really went onto Facebook because you can reach more people that way.
Amazing, isn't it? And our page has something like 22,000 people on it. Not all of them are active, of course, but it's just amazing how you can reach so many people through that site. But when you think there's 2 billion people on there, it's kind of hard. It's amazing. So what got you interested in the topic to begin with?
I suppose it really goes back when I was a young child and had a sighting with my sister when I was about 7 years old, which is during the 1970s. And it was in Liverpool near the, I don't know if you've heard of the racetrack in Liverpool, Aintree Racecourse. And we were basically playing as young kids do. And she sort of got my attention and said, "Do you see that outside the window?" And we both looked, and there was a silver disc-shaped object outside the window. We both observed it, and then it took off at high velocity. And then we just seemed to carry on playing as if nothing had happened. And and I'd actually forgotten about it. It was my sister that brought it back up. Only when I started getting into, you know, the page and writing different things. So a bit of a weird one.
So it was kind of subliminally there, maybe. But, you know, you are not the first one that has said that, that I've heard. A lot of people have forgotten about sightings, and something either triggers it. I think it was Peter Robbins had a major sighting with his sister when they were young. Also, he was with his sister, and he forgotten all about it. He totally forgot about it until his sister brought it up. You know, so it is it's not uncommon at all. And I find that kind of funny that someone could forget something that, you know, that amazing.
But important.
Yeah. And you've had another sighting too, right?
I've had a few different things that have happened, obviously, but the one that's in the book really is the I was on the base a night at RAF Cosford, which is a base, a Royal Air Force base in the UK in the Midlands, not far from Birmingham, Wolverhampton area. And it was during March 1993. And my friend, he was in the guard room. He was in charge of the guard room that night, the orderly corporal. And basically, I didn't see, I was in the billets at the time, and he told me about it all later, and we got into more depth. And he said it was nice and quiet at night. It was late night going into the next day, as you expect, and you want it to be when you're doing a gate guard, you want it to be nice and quiet. And he said all of a sudden the radio burst into life, and there was a young trainee, because RAF Cosford is also a training camp where they train armourers and different trades and disciplines. And he said there was a young trainee on the gate guard on the airfield, which is actually on the front of the book, you can see, and in the book, the actual guard post is in there. I'd take photographs of it, and then it's there to see for yourself. And he said this young lad was screaming down the radio to get the guard commander out to the base, because there was a huge black triangular-shaped craft over the airfield. And then other people that did see it when they all got there, the guard commander, the RAF police, and all different people went out there in the Land Rovers, etc., got there, and they all described the same thing as seeing this huge black triangular-shaped craft, and they described it the size of a battleship, which is quite huge, really. You're probably talking 800 feet plus. And this thing obviously startled the young lad, and he was quite shook up about it. And then he took off from RAF Cosford and then went on to another RAF base, which is not too far away as the crow flies, which is RAF Shawbury, which is a helicopter base. It's probably 15, 20 miles away. And the on-duty air traffic controller in the evening saw this craft coming in over the base, and they actually got a radar lock on it. And he said that it was firing lasers down over the airfield, and wow. His impressions were that it was trying to look for something. That was the impression he got, and then it obviously took off from there. But throughout that evening leading up to the sightings on the RAF bases, it was seen throughout the UK, and they were, whether it was the same craft and maybe another craft, we don't know, but similar craft were seen throughout the UK by on-duty policemen and civilians, and you know, quite a few people. So it's quite documented.
Now, does it have, you know, like, for instance, there's the Bentwater, Rendlesham Forest case, stuff like that. Does this actually have like a case name? Is it Cosford? What was the?
Yeah, it's RAF Cosford, which is Cosford. It's an actual RAF base.
Yeah.
Actually, the day after, Nick Pope came out to the base and he had dealings with it and the personnel, and it obviously after investigating it himself. And he was in Whitehall at the time on the British X-Files desk when he was working there. And in the book, I've actually put links there where people can go freely onto YouTube, etc., and see Nick talking about the case.
So did you actually meet Nick at the time, or did you see him there, or just hear about it afterwards? Yeah,
you just knew about him. When puzzled and brought the whole case together, and obviously Nick had spoke about it for years. You know, he's not sort of held back on it, and he actually wrote quite a big piece in the book for me at the beginning regarding my leading up to, you know, the sighting, and then his piece afterwards, the way he dealt with it, and etc. So it's quite interesting.
How did the MOD leave that case? Just as an unknown?
Yeah, it's still unsolved case, unidentified to what the craft was. Over time, you come up with your own conclusions and things, and I think it probably was a secret covert black military, you know, covert project, because a lot of sightings, I'm sure, Through my research and going down those avenues, a lot of people, I think, see craft and it's unidentified, because obviously UFO, that's what it stands for, unidentified flying object. So when they don't know what the craft is, and if it's secret covert, that's not seen by most people in the general public sense, it's unidentified. And I think that suits the military. The secret covert projects, that people don't know what they're seeing, so it's the perfect cover story for them.
But why would it shoot down lasers at the ground, though? I mean, that part doesn't make much sense.
No, there are other things that could lead on to, you know, you thinking other, could it be extraterrestrial? Again, whether they know about it and they're not saying, you know, higher authorities, but you're going off the facts of the sightings and what people saw and what was recorded on the evening. So with it still being unidentified, it still leaves the door open to being whichever, really.
did anyone talk about any noise coming from the craft?
No, the only noise was like a humming sound.
Yeah, that's the one you always hear about the triangles. You hear about a humming.
Yeah, and but no sound at all. No, as it took off at high velocity, and you have to remember military personnel see aircraft, fighter aircraft, and military aircraft, so they know what they're looking at. They see the speeds they can fly at, and this thing actually took off so fast, but there was no as if it was breaking through a sound barrier, so there was no boom or anything else.
That's you always hear that too. Even tracked on radar, going thousands of miles an hour, no sonic boom.
No,
so
no,
it's just totally baffling, isn't it?
And in the book, I've actually managed to get hold of the official military documents, which have been released by the MOD since. Mm. So they're in the book, and when the investigation had been taking place through the sighting itself, they did actually contact a lot of other military bases throughout the UK who have got the overall radar scope. So, Bryce Norton and RAF Lyne and all the big places that have the bigger radar patches. And I'm not sure whether they actually picked it up or not, but it was still unidentified because it was not one of ours.
Now, at the Rendlesham Forest incident, there was some speculation that there was possibly some nuclear warheads, possibly. You can never say for sure. And when I've had Charles Hult on my show, he did not want to talk about it, and I totally respect that. He can't. But were there any weapons on that base in particular?
No.
Of any kind? None?
No, it's a training camp. So, like mm-hmm. I said, the actual things that they have on the camp are training aids, etc. There is a large museum there where they've got all different types of aircraft throughout RAF history, etc. Military, American, all foreign militaries there. So really, I don't know why. Personally, it could have been there for any other reason other than, like you've just said, other craft have been seen over military installations, etc., throughout the world. So,
right.
Yeah.
Another thing that always comes to mind, when this was in 1993, right? Is that when you said it was?
Yeah.
So 1993, and all this time goes by. You would think that there would be, if it was secret military craft, you would think that that technology would be known by now. Wouldn't you think that? I mean, that's always kind of puzzling to me. I mean, if something like that was that advanced that it could take off in that type of speed, you just think that we would know something about it by now.
Yeah, you certainly would, people do say what they've got in the secret covert cloakroom cupboard is 50 years ahead of what we've actually got flying around in the military now. So,
yeah, I've heard people say 20 years. I haven't never heard 50 years, but, nothing would actually surprise me. But it just seems, I know these people are under top secret, clearances. They can't talk. They're contracted. But it just seems like we would seem to know something a little if these things, especially when something can stay elevated without moving, can hover and not have any, propulsion of any kind that you can actually see.
Yeah. Like anti-gravity, et cetera, all that type of thing. Yeah.
Right. So let's talk about some of the cases that you have researched, and what made you decide to do the research that you do?
Oh, really, it stemmed from my sighting, really, and things that have happened, and then obviously the Cosford thing. So I didn't research into it until I'd actually left the Air Force. and it just seemed to escalate, really. There wasn't many people out there who could actually answer my questions, so it was really roll your sleeves up and get in. And the internet was becoming better and better, a better tool to research. So it was making it easier to find things out. And the more you found out, the more I'd be looking into one case, for example, and generally another five doors would open with different cases again leading off that one. And it just it got worse and worse. And I just put it down to what do I call it? The Richard Dreyfuss syndrome, where you just
starting to build the mountain in the house.
Yeah, you become manic, and I wouldn't say sleepless nights, but you do think about it an awful lot. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It is interesting. I've heard a number of people say the same thing, that you know, one thing kind of leads into another, and a lot of times when they people that have written a book, it's like after the book, they're contacted by all these people. Has that been happening?
Oh, you know, it happened before the book, really. The book, like you said, was a progression, and I was speaking with Philip, and it sort of progressed from there, and how we would approach the book or how I would write it. And like, Philip's been a great help to me, because I've never wrote a book before, obviously. And I really needed to... I wanted to be a layman's type of book, where somebody who had not really been into ufology, where we all start at one point. It's a bit of a DIY book where you pick it up and it gives you the basics of what to look for, how to analyze photographs, etc., misidentifications, and just basically leading you in slowly. And then I thought, how am I going to put the UFO cases across? So I thought, well, if I start with the first case, which was in, you know, late 1800s, and go every 10 years on from there, from major cases. And again, when I started to delve and research, which I've researched most of these cases anyway, like anybody else would, where, you know, you pick up a book and you start reading Chariots of the Gods or Eric Van Danek, and, you know, you start somewhere. So you research the well-known cases. But when I actually started to analyze the photographs, I was coming out with more detail that had never been seen before. So as you get deeper into it, and you can see, and it was even amazing myself, really, when I was getting into it even more.
Okay, I'd like to start out talking about one thing. You're probably not going to be too happy about it, but I live on top of a mountain in Maine, and I can, over from my house, I can actually see Mount Washington. And I want to talk about the 1870 Mount Washington stereo opticon view card, because the only reason I know about that is because I'm local to the mountain, and I also know a UFO researcher that went into great detail. So go ahead. It's going to be pulled up on the screen right now on YouTube for those people watching on YouTube, and I can also put it in the show notes. So this is a stereo opticon. It's a Victorian era stereo opticon view card. You put it, you basically wear this thing, not, you know, wear it, you hold it in front of your face, and it's two magnifying glasses, and it holds in front of you. And it actually becomes three-dimensional when you look at it with that stereopticon viewer. So this image actually was researched by a number of people, one of them being Ryan Mullahy in New Hampshire. And it appears so much like it's floating in the clouds. But go ahead and pull up that close-up next. And I know, Jason, I'm sorry you can't see this.
Yeah, it's all right.
It actually becomes a structure that is in the snow. And it's awful hard to detect the snow between the cloud. But when the person went to the New York, it's in the New York Public Library, the original image, before it was made into a stereopticon card. We're also going to show a couple of other pictures that were taken the very same day, showing the frost elements up on Mount Washington. So anyway, basically what that is a structure on that's sitting on top of Mount Washington, and it's basically blended in, you know, with the clouds. So, and that was by the good work of Ryan Mullahy and also another UFO researcher that actually went to see this original image at the New York Public Library. And because it's an original image, you know how important that is. You can see so much more detail. So so I hate to start out on a negative, but it's one I believe that has been solved. Now, I'm not saying it's 100% that it is, but most likely it has been solved as some type of structure.
Yeah. If I was proven wrong, I'd be the first person to say I was wrong and, you know, go back. But I was going off the photograph that I'd seen and analysed. But if, you know, somebody's actually been up on site and location, that's even better again. You know, I'll certainly look into that one deeper.
You know, I personally was very disappointed because that's a local mountain to me. Like I said, I can look out my window and see it. And I was thinking, wow, that is such a great case, you know. And I know the original Stereopticon card sold for something like $380 on eBay. Yeah. And they're worth about $5 a piece, so that $380 is quite a bit of money. Someone thought they were buying the first original UFO. are there any other pictures, vintage pictures of UFOs that you've actually have found when you're researching?
Just generally, I wanted to go every 10 years. So obviously I don't do every single photograph, but the next one I went on was the Catalan UFO over France, 1910. And it's a picture basically of a racetrack, and you can see the spectators and the car coming round the racetrack itself. And it looks like a cigar cylindrical shaped craft above. Again, unless you had other photographs and you can go into it in more detail and actually have the original photograph, you can only really analyze on what you can get, or, you know, you can download, etc. And again, it was basically for the book where I wanted to just go along the decades and try and ease people into cases before we got into the more modern, you know, modern day photographs.
Right, right. I had the woman that, I'm trying to remember the name of the famous UFO photo that was taken by a publisher with a Polaroid out of a truck in California. Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah, I think so. I haven't got the access to it in a minute, but I know it's at the side of a truck window, is it?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, and you can see a disc. I did think about actually going into that in more depth, but I'd already covered a case from that era, so I sort of didn't go into too many.
Well, that original is available, actually. And let's see, that was Heflin was the name, Rex Heflin. Mm. And so I had a woman on my show back in February who actually has that picture, the original Polaroids in her safe. And
right.
So you can actually see the originals and actually hold them in your hand. But, you know, Polaroids, they're not they're a little bit tough, aren't they, to deal with? I mean, they're not quite the quality of a regular photograph, right?
No, they're not. And again, with any photograph, you know, whether you're past, modern, you know, I always try and ask for the original photograph the best you can get, because if you're trying to analyze photographs of being on the internet, you don't know how many times that photograph has been posted and reposted, etc. So you're going through third, fourth, fifth generation of the same photograph. And obviously, the more you go through this process, the more, you know, the quality degrades and it's harder to actually analyze.
Yeah, I can get that. What about videos? Do you do a lot of work with that as well?
Not so much, but I do look into videos, because you can get frame captures from the actual video, because obviously there's no other photographs available. You have to use the video to get you, what you're actually looking at, and then you can take a frame from the, you know, stills from the actual video or footage.
Now, what I guess it would matter how many frames per second the film is running at. But is digital different than that? Is digital the same thing as far as frames per second?
I'm not quite sure whether it would be the... If you go back to the older cine film, then obviously, yeah, the actual the running speed, etc., everything is different. So you can actually get more frames in it, actually. But with the digital, it seems you can... It depends as well on the object, how fast it's flying, you know, location, lighting. There's a lot of thing factors involved in that, you know, when you're trying to analyze it. And obviously on the quality as well, whether it's 1080 or 4K or, you know, 720 for the pixels in the actual footage.
Right, right. I remember I had... When I got my first iPhone, I can't remember when it was. I was living in California, and I remember they were kind of primitive back then as far as video and filming. But I remember I went out in the evening for a walk, and I was filming and aiming up at the stars, and then I watched it afterwards, and it's all these blurs and lines, you know, like it looks like a UFO, you know, and I have people that will send me pictures. I get a lot of pictures, by the way, you know, emailed to me. And I'll have people send me pictures of that looks like the streaks of just basically holding your iPhone or, you know, camera up at the sky and just moving it a little bit. And it makes these, like, streaks across, like light streaks.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think unless you actually see something with your eye and then see it, you know, in the camera at the same time, you know, the witnesses are pretty important, I think.
Yeah. There's, like you just said, there's a lot of factors involved. And if you could see the object and then you get your camera out and take a photograph, you've got a double aspect of what you've taken. But then you've got also a lot of people. I get an awful lot of photographs from people who have taken pictures. And if you actually look at the footage, they're like an orb shape in it. But it's just lens flare from the sun, which is it's very common.
I know there's so many lens flare photos, and then there's also some Google Earth pink UFOs, which is actually. Yeah. Have you heard of that? There's a Mark D'Antonio. Are you familiar with who he is?
No.
He is the MUFON, you know, video photo analyst, basically, and he does a lot of work for them. He's also does special effects and models and things like that. But he and I were basically arguing with this guy on Facebook, and then we gave up and just let the guy think what he wants to think. But he was saying we were the government against him and everything else, and all we were saying is those are well-known, those pink UFOs are well-known lens flares.
Yeah.
And they do. Yeah. They're actually convincing. I can understand why someone can look at that and say, wow, that's a disc right there.
Yeah, definitely. And sometimes you do have to sort of back away and let people just get on with it, because you're just going to upset somebody, aren't you, for no reason, when if they want to believe they've seen something, then so be it. And
well, after, so I just got to tell you, because I think this is kind of humorous. So this guy basically was telling me to, you know, bug off, and like I was a government idiot and a debunker and, and, you know, so anyway, he obviously searched my Facebook page after that. And then he found out that I have an interest in antiques, and I, you know, I'm an appraiser in antiques. So he started sending me pictures of a glass, I hate to even say this, but a glass urinal. He wanted to know how valuable it was. And I said, oh my God, I just kind of deleted it and moved on. But
Yeah.
So yeah, it's there's you can attract some a couple of crazies actually out there. So let's talk about some of the more convincing ones that you've looked at. When I say convincing, I mean unexplainable. UFOs that you've actually studied and try to figure out what they were.
Yeah, sure. From the book or?
Yeah, yeah. From, go ahead from the book, yeah. Sure.
Yeah, well, one of the convincing ones, which I've looked at myself for years, is the Battle over Los Angeles,
oh, yeah.
which is 1942. And it, again, that to this day is still unidentified. And it was a large craft that came over, and I was like everybody else. I'd just seen the original photographs, well, the latest, the best I could find. And they basically show you the searchlights, which are on this object. It looks sort of diamond-shaped initially, but when you look at it. And you can see the searchlights on it. You can see the artillery. They were actually firing at it. Are you, do you know about this case? Or?
Oh, yes. It's always yeah. fascinated me. I know, for one, David Marler was going to start working on that. He was going to start on researching that. I know a number of people have, but that's always fascinated me. That's a great, very unusual case. I know there was something like either two or four people that were actually killed.
I think it was more. I think it was about, I did have a thing somewhere where it was more like eight people or maybe three people were killed in a car crash, and a couple of other people had heart attacks.
Right.
It was.
And then actually from some of the shells.
The shells
landing.
Falling. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
A couple people killed from that.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I think America had just come into the Second World War. So the military and people must have thought that it was a Japanese craft or German Luftwaffe aircraft coming over. So obviously it was a free-for-all. Everybody opened up at this thing, and it just didn't move at all. It was moving slowly through the skyline of Los Angeles, but they didn't bring it down or anything. And to this day, they still don't know.
Did you ever hear about during the World War II, the Japanese had these balloons that they would launch into the prevailing winds eastward toward the LA, the California coastline?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. They used to put incendiary devices on them, didn't they? On like a crude,
yeah, very crude.
release mechanism. And it would, their intention was to release the bombs over the city, weren't they? And then they would go up very high and go on, eventually get to America and that region and release the bombs.
Yeah, can you imagine if that war was now with the technology we have now? I mean, it's so funny. I mean, it is very primitive. And that whole, but it was just anything to get us. That was kind of scary. But
and that's what everybody must have thought that night. The craft coming over, it was something to do with coming into the war, etc. And when I actually analysed the photographs, I don't know if you've seen them in the book, the detail that came out of the craft, and you can actually see structure to the craft itself.
Really?
Yeah, it amazed myself really when I actually set to work on it, because like I said, the actual case, I've always been interested in it, like most people, for years, but I thought it'd be a good one for the book. And I thought, well, nobody's ever gone down the road of analysing the photographs to the depth that I did myself, and the detail that came out, it doesn't even look diamond shaped anymore. And it's I don't know if you've got a photograph there at all that you can see, or
I just have a picture up on my own screen, but not from your book. Where it just shows up. It shows the searchlights, zeroing in on something with probably the shells blasting overhead. I think they shot off something like 1,500 rounds, right, or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, an awful lot. And like I said, this thing was still there. It didn't move. It didn't bring it down or damage it in any way.
Do you know what made them stop firing? I mean, did it go away?
Yeah, it did actually disappear over the skyline slowly. It was slowly moving all the time, but not like it was trying to evacuate the area under fire, you know. And it was lost over the skyline, I think. But obviously that's why they gave up shooting at it, you know, because it's out of range.
Do you know how they first were aware of it? Was it a radar? Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, was it radar? Or how did they first know that it was over L.A.?
I don't actually know how it first intention, but obviously the first thing people knew was when the searchlights were all on it and it was all illuminated, and then obviously the firing started and all hell broke loose and, you know, on from there. But looking through the book with the photographs, and you do see what the craft looks like. It doesn't look anything like the original photograph that you see, you know, where you can just see the object is illuminated, so if you get a glazed look over it, there's no real detail on it. But when you use the filters and things and bring out the detail, you can see the structure to it.
You know, this was, 5 years prior to what they term the modern ufology, after Roswell, basically, all the sightings that began in 1947 on. So this was 5 years ahead of that. Had anyone ever brought up at that time that it was possibly, you know, a UFO, or was that like after the fact, many years after the fact?
I think it was more after the fact, because at the time, I think that's what they thought it was. It was something, it was involved in the war effort and,
yeah,
you know, related to them actually 3 months prior getting it after Pearl Harbor and things like that. And everything progressed. I think it was a lot later on that they actually it went down the road of the UFO, which that was the term that came out later through Kenneth Arnold, wasn't it, with the flying disc, etc. So, you know, things progressed from there on. But going way, way back, UFOs have been seen for millennia. They go back. It's all documented, isn't it, through...
Yeah, it's funny. It just, you know, when you do any type of research, or I know Jacques Vallée with another author did work on, you know, real early sightings going as far back as they could research. You know, these sightings occurred, but they were never on the regular basis. Well, I say that now we're so connected. You know, prior to being so connected as we are now, there may have been sightings, you know, but just that no one ever had any place to report them, or no one ever reported them.
No.
You know, you think of, 100 years ago or 150 years ago, you know, there may have been many sightings that never made it to paper, you know, written down or even verbalized or told. So,
well, I've started... Partly started my next book, and I'm going into sightings and different things, close encounters, because obviously close encounters comes under 7 different categories of first, second, third, and fourth, etc. But just to skirt over it, really. But going back in ancient Egypt, there was a sighting by the pharaohs, and it was reported of orbs that had come over, and I don't want to give too much away because I want to put it in the next book, but, you know, as you're just saying, going back, that there are documented, you know, examples of sightings that are there if you look.
Yeah. I have not bought Jacques' book in particular, but I would like to get it just to, because that really does fascinate me. Now, I know there's one that has been debunked, the Alexander the Great sighting, that they saw a shield during a battle up in the sky and all that. But anyway, that ended up only being able to be researched back, I think, to 1954 in a novel or a fiction novel. That was basically as far back as it could be researched. So right. I don't think that one actually holds any water in particular. But there are so many more, you know, besides that, that, you know, really have been written down, which is quite amazing.
Yeah.
And so before we go on in your book, let's talk about the sighting in France and the helicopter, these two objects go by it. Is that actually in your book, or is that just something you've looked at?
No, that's actually in my book.
Okay, so you don't mind if we skip around a little bit?
No, fine. That was a ship that had run aground off the French coast. I think it was Anglet on the French coast. And the ship was a cargo ship, which is called the Luno. And, well, basically it ran aground. And the footage I actually saw, it was going way back, 2014, I think. I originally saw the photo, the images and the footage. And the footage was taken from a local television news broadcast, which has since mysteriously gone missing. We can't seem to trace it now. But I managed to get the short piece out of the footage that I was basically watching it because the interest was the ship which had run aground, and obviously it was a storm, etc., and people were being rescued by the helicopters. So, you know, you watch this sort of thing. And as I was watching the footage, these two objects flew right behind. It was a French military helicopter that had got there first, who were winching people off the ship. And as I was watching it, these two objects, which are in the book, you can see all the photographs. And if you look on my YouTube channel, the footage is there as well. And you can see the two craft. And I describe as craft that they're in close formation and they fly right behind the helicopter off to the side. And at first impression, I thought maybe they were birds or, you know, the usual type of thing, and because you can see other birds flying around. And when I analyzed, well, I'll take a closer look, analyze them in more detail. When I actually looked closer, they look metallic in shape and size, and they stayed exactly the same distance from each other. And then I was starting to think, well, were they drones? Were they something that were being used by the military at the time as a help? But then they wouldn't be flying drones in those conditions, and especially not close to rescue helicopters, etc. So I thought it'd be a good one to put in the book, which, you know, obviously everyone can see it there in the book.
Now, was this first noticed by when they were doing the newscasts of it, or how did this come out?
No. It was myself. I was actually watching the footage, and like I said, it wasn't the UFOs were the bonus sort of thing, because I wasn't watching for UFOs. I was watching because the ship had run aground and it was an interesting story, and they were being rescued, you know, with the helicopter. And then I sat up and took more notice because it was a military helicopter, and I thought, oh yeah, okay, maybe they got there first. And you start asking more questions. And then as I was watching the footage, the broadcast, the two objects flew past and it made me sit up, and I thought, I've got to get a still of that. I've got to have a look and take a proper look myself. And it sort of progressed from there.
Boy, so you're actually the person that actually uncovered this.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Wow, that's actually really... And it's funny you said you weren't expecting to see UFOs. Are we ever?
No.
We're,
No, not when you go out intentionally trying to look for them. But it was myself who found the UFOs within the footage, and it wasn't of UFOs originally. I was looking. I didn't even record it. I managed to get a video clip that was on YouTube, and like I said, since I've had people approach me. I mean, it's gone huge. It's made all the newspapers, the New York Post. It went everywhere. This
right.
It went all over the world. I had producers of all the channels asking for permission to show it, and of course, I'm going to say yes. As you know, I just found it. I'm not into that side of thing. You know, I want the truth out there. Mm-hmm. And basically, you know, they think it's all been sort of made, and that's exactly how it came about. I was watching the ship run aground, etc., and I saw them, because I generally watch footage that people send me, photographs and other things, and I'm always looking for the the other things that are happening. I don't always look at the main event, if you know what I mean.
Right. I know that you must have been interested in at least talking to people and finding out more about the Rendlesham Forest case. I know that happened in 1980. Because it was at, you know, the RAF Bentwaters. So that in particular, supposedly there were some pictures taken, but I think they said they never came out. I think that's what it was.
Well, yeah, the it was over a couple of nights on the base, wasn't it? I'm supposed to actually be going down there and spending the night in the forest down there. I haven't got round to it yet.
Yeah.
Because I've got a couple of friends down there who were into the, you know, research, etc. And I think Colonel Holt, I'll get to meet Colonel Holt. He's coming over for a conference in the UK. The Outer Limits magazine, who I wrote articles for as well, in Hull. I think it's September. I can't remember the actual date. I think it's September, but it's all there on the internet. And Colonel Holt's going to be one of the speakers. So I can have a proper chat with him, hopefully, when he comes over. But
Very approachable guy. I met him first down in North Carolina about four or five years ago.
Oh, right.
Very approachable, nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
Likes things just so, though. You know, I mean, he's very particular. And, you know, someone that's going to be a commander of a base is going to be like that.
Yeah, of course. I mean, at the time, this was a few years after, because it was, I think it was 1980, Rendlesham Forest incident happened, but in the, I think it was sort of the mid 80s onwards, when I was at RAF Cosford for my first time. I've been at Cosford a couple of times on different tours. We used to get go out in detachments and things where we'd go and do guard duty at other bases. One of the bases I went to was Greenham Connon. You know, where you used to have the protesters there for the nuclear weapons. Don't know if you remember that on the news. You used to have all the women there. And that was the nearest base to Bentwaters and up there. Because Rendlesham Forest is the actual forest there. It's Bentwaters and Woodbridge are the two military bases there.
Yeah, Woodbridge, right. Yeah. Peter Robbins is coming up in a couple of weeks, and one of the conversations we're going to have is he had a falling out with his co-author. We're going to be talking a little bit about that, Larry. So there was a question, that, not really a question. Someone said the best UFO case, and this is up in the chat room, the best UFO case in the UK is the Alan Godfrey encounter. Are you familiar with that?
Not in detail, obviously, but I didn't know we were going to discuss it, but Alan was a policeman. He was on duty at the time. I'm not sure if it was the 70s, And he was with a colleague, and they had a close encounter. A ship came down, and it's quite well documented, and he's had quite a few talks. He started to do conferences and things like that. So I missed his last one he did, so hopefully I'm going to try and catch him, you know, when he does one.
I have a guest coming up in a few weeks that the whole show is going to be about police officers and UFO encounters. That should be to me, I think, and I've had an argument, I've kind of argued this fact with someone before, a skeptic, that I think that actually personally, I think that police officers are good observers. I think that they're very credible. I mean, yeah. I think they're the last people in the world that want to talk about a UFO, you know, really. I mean, for the ridicule, you go all the way back to Lonnie Zamora, you know, in the Socorro case, you know, didn't want any of the hassle of reporting what he saw, but, you know, very, very credible person. But anyway, I always like those cases.
Yeah, most people like to listen to those, like you just said, for the credibility of the people and the witnesses.
Right. And witnesses are like, is such a big piece of the puzzle. And in your research, in your book, did you try to actually talk to people, or did you read accounts of witnesses?
It really, it was cases first. There's a couple in there. There was, I think there's one at the beginning where it's a misidentification. Just really go to the beginning. Philip Mantle, he actually sent me two photographs of a sighting, or supposedly sighting, that somebody had taken. And the gentleman was he was actually a civilian passenger aircraft pilot, Brazil. I'm sure he was Brazilian. Anyway, he was over in Wiltshire in the UK on holiday, and he took photographs. And what the two photographs I was sent by Philip, first one, straight away I could see it was a military aircraft. It was a Tornado. It was actually the type of aircraft I'd worked on in the Air Force before, so I knew straight away that it was a military aircraft. But the second photograph, the center of the photo, it's in the book, you can see it again. The center of the photograph is a flagpole with a Union Jack flag on the top. And obviously that was the focus of his photograph that he was taking, his topic. And either side of the flagpole, you can see two, they looked like disc-shaped objects. And when I first saw it, I did actually think, well, we might have something here. You know, I'll go and do a proper analysis of it and see what I can come up with. And then when obviously I did do the analysis and got further into it, they too were military aircraft. And when I got into the detail, and again, it's all there for you to see, one of the aircraft was banking, and it was two more military aircraft again. And one was banking, and one was actually flying away. And what I've actually done is do silhouettes of the aircraft type next to it, so you can make a comparison and you can see it for yourself. And when you do see it, you go, oh yeah, of course, that's what it is. But first impression of the photograph and etc., they were UFOs because they were unidentified.
Well, you know, there's really something about when an aircraft is banking and turning, and you know, I mean, there are certain times that you could snap a picture or see it, you know, even in a video, where it looks unusual and doesn't look like an aircraft at all, especially, you know, at a distance.
Yeah, definitely.
I just wanted to announce, I'm going to be doing for the people on YouTube, it's going to be on YouTube only, this Sunday evening on the 29th, I think it's 9 o'clock, I'm going to be live doing like a simulcast with a radio station. I'm going to be talking UFOs. But that will be here on my YouTube channel, 9 o'clock Sunday night. And it's also going to be on KGRA, a radio host over there. Cobra is his name. But we're going to be talking UFOs. So Sunday night, Any YouTube listener can listen to that. So that's it for the free show. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, you can support us for $2 or more a month. All that information is on Podcast UFO, and you can listen to the full two-hour shows and archives all the way back to, I think, 120-something. Anyway, thanks so much for listening. And remember, you can listen to the full shows either live on YouTube or on Podcast UFO on Wednesdays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, or over at the Dark Matter Digital Network on Thursdays, 10 to midnight Eastern Standard Time. Next week, we have Jane Kyle on Texas UFOs. I want to thank the people that help out with the show. First of all, our guest, Jason Gleaves, also Evan for helping in the background, and Peggy for managing the Facebook page. All right, everyone, so remember to keep your eyes to the sky.